We're in the book of Leviticus, chapter number 19, verse number 9 is where we'll begin. The book of Leviticus is a rule book for the Levites. It's to help the priests and the Levites know the procedures they're supposed to carry out in regards to the tabernacle and sacrifices and things of that nature. But it is also to help the Levites teach and instruct and guide the rest of the Israelis in proper day-to-day procedure. So we've been seeing things related to blood and things related to sexual activity. Now we're going to spread out into some other things that the Israelis as a larger group need to know how to do. Leviticus 19:9 says, "Now, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest." Now, let's get some terminology right here. The harvest that we're talking about here is a grain harvest to begin with. So we've got these grain fields that have been sown by hand, and the grain has grown up, and once it's reached its ripe point, they're going to go out there with a sharp sickle, and they're going to grab a bunch of stalks of grain and chop it off and kind of bundle it up and throw it off to the side into a pile, and then they'll just repeat that process over and over again. This instruction here is that when you do this, you don't go all the way up to the edge of your field. You're going to leave a band of unharvested grain around the edge. And when you gather up the bundles that you've made, any loose strands that have fallen out or that you missed getting bundled properly, you just leave those in the field. Now, what's the purpose of that? We'll come to that in a moment. Verse 10. "Nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard." The vineyard is where the grapevines are, and you don't go through and pick every single grape, is what's being said here. "Nor do you pick up the fallen grapes off the ground." So the goal would have been that you pick the day on which the majority of your grape harvest is ripe. And you're going to go through and you're going to cut off those grape clusters that are clearly ripe and put them in your basket, and you're going to carry them off. Now, any grape clusters you come across that are not completely ripe, you leave them on the vine. And anything that falls to the ground, you leave them on the ground. And the reason you do these things, and by the way, you're going to do something similar to your other trees, and it's not mentioned here, but let me just go ahead and use olive tree for an example. The olive harvest was done by picking a day on which you thought that the olives were at their peak ripeness. And you would go out and you'd beat on the limbs of the trees, and those olives that were ripe would fall off of the tree down into a net that you'd prepared, or a canvas sort of thing underneath the tree. And then you'd pick those nets or those canvases up, and you'd dump the olives that had fallen off into baskets and stuff. Well, the olives that weren't quite ripe would stay on the tree, and you don't go up there and pick them off. And the olives that missed the net, or missed the canvas, or maybe you missed the basket whisk when you were dumping the canvas. All those things fall on the ground, you leave them there. And you don't pick up the olives that had already fallen off the tree either. So why all of this avoidance of part of the fruit of the harvest? Well, verse 10 says, "You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am he who is your God." So this was part of the social assistance program, that every year when it came to harvest time, the working poor, would gather to those areas that were being harvested, and anything that was left behind by the harvesters, by dropping them by accident or by things that were not quite ripe yet, those became the possession of the working poor. And they could go in and collect everything that they could and wanted to do for their own use, or perhaps even to be sold so that they could have the cash in order to buy other necessities. So this is part of their social support system for the poor. We'll hear more about this support system later. Verse 11, you shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. Now, this is the appropriate moral stance that we should always have. And the Israelis are told at the beginning of their lives as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation that that's how they're supposed to act. Don't be stealing from other people. Private property is private property. If you want something that somebody else has, either ask to borrow it or offer to buy it or exchange something of equal value. Don't deal falsely. That would get to the equal value thing. You don't try to cheat people out of stuff. And you don't lie to each other. You speak the truth in love, as the New Testament puts it. You shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am he who is. This is actually what is meant in the Ten Commandments about do not use the name of the Lord your God in vain. You don't make oaths. This is the Israeli instruction. You don't make oaths in the name of he who is so that you could twist people into doing what you want to be done or to get them to believe things that are not true. Because when you use God to do wrong things, you're doing a wrong thing to God as well. And as he said in the Ten Commandments, I will not leave unpunished the one who uses my name in vain. Verse 13, you shall not oppress your neighbor nor rob him. Now, robbing him is outright taking things that he has that belong to him that you want, and you take them by force. Oppression is where you basically put the pressure on him to give such things up and kind of cheat him. This is not appropriate. Everybody needs to be treated with respect, and their private property needs to be treated with respect. This really gets into the idea of the golden rule. You do unto others as you would have them do to you. You love them like God loves them. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you all night until morning. At this time in their history, everybody was to be paid their wages on a daily basis. Because often the people who worked for these daily wages needed that money to get their necessities of the day. Now, right now, the Israelis don't have that problem because they're getting everything provided by God. They've got manna 6 days a week, twice amount on that sixth day so they can get through the week, through the weekend, through Sabbath day. They're getting all their water provided. The animals that they've got with them is being used in sacrifice. Even the neighbors around the different tents that they're offering sacrifices, they're getting that part of meat as well. So they've got equity that's going on right now in the Israeli encampment. But once they get into the promised land, these rules need to apply. If you hire someone to work for you, at the end of the day, you pay them what you said you would. Don't leave them hanging. And usually when I talk about this, I try to make an application to our modern time period. If you are a Christian employer, I would urge you to think very seriously about when you first hire someone, even if the rest of your company is getting paid week by week or bi-monthly, you know, twice a month, every other week. If you've got a new hire that you're bringing on board that you know is having a tough time making ends meet, pay them daily for the first part of their hire period, because they're going to have things that they have to pay. You know, when you move into a new apartment, you often have to pay a couple of months ahead plus a security deposit. Well, how are you going to do that if you don't get paid for 2 weeks into the future? So this was the sort of answer that God was giving to the Israelis, is pay people day by day so that they can meet their needs. Verse 14, you shall not curse a deaf man. Oh, how rude is that? And yet I have seen examples of this, of people mocking those that can't hear by saying things right behind them. It's just so wrong. Nor should you place a stumbling block before the blind, taking advantage of the fact that they can't see, so you want to make them trip over something so that you can laugh at them. Well, God says about that, you shall revere your God. I am He who is. So when you disrespect people with limited abilities, because of those limited abilities, you're disrespecting God. Because He's watching as you treat them with that sort of disrespect. And they've been made in His image and likeness. Yes, the curse has caused problems, because that's where blindness and deafness comes from. It comes from the curse that came upon this earth because of sin. But they are still His son, His daughter, made in His image and likeness, and they need to be treated with respect. Verse 15, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. This verse is so very important. God wants us to treat everyone fairly across the board. Even if the person is poor, that's no reason to give them a judgment in their favor when really all the facts go against them. You need to be fair in every circumstance. Now, you may have pity upon them. For example, they've done something that involves a fine, and you feel sorry about the fact that they're going to have to pay this fine. You don't go, well, you're poor, so let's just forget the fine. That's not fair. What could be merciful is to say, well, the fine is a shekel for what you did, but I know a shekel is awfully hard to come by for you right now, so I'm going to pay your shekel fine for you. That would be the appropriate thing to do, because the fine has been assessed. And of course, you should never defer to the great just because they're great, because you want to get on their good side. You don't accept bribes to go into the favor of somebody that has a little bit more money. So God basically tells the Israelis, be blind in your justice. You look at the facts alone, and make your judgment on that. Verse number 16. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am He who is. So two things here. Basically, you don't go around lying about people, telling stories about people. That's wrong. And you don't take action in order to get somebody killed when that isn't what should be happening to them. One of the big problems that I think is being referred to here is basically offering false testimony that would result in somebody being executed. We will come across a place later in regards to judicial testimony. That if you testify in a case against somebody and it's found out that you perjured yourself, that you lied, that whatever it was that that person's penalty would have been will be assessed to you. So if you lied, say, in a theft case, somebody had stolen something that was worth $100, and if they were found guilty, they'd have to pay back $120. And you lied about it to get them in trouble, and then they found out, the judge found out you were lying. Guess who would have to pay the $120? You would. And you'd be paying it to the person that you lied about. But worse yet, if you lied in a capital case, you bore testimony that somebody, you saw somebody murder somebody else, well, that would mean that they should be executed. If it's found out that you lied about what you saw, then you'd be the one executed. Because you need to be 100% fair in everything you do and say in your life. The Israelis are being told that they need to do this because they represent God. They're supposed to be holy as He is holy. They are supposed to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, a peculiar people, a people for His own possession. Well, guess what? All of that is applied to us in the new covenant today. So Christians are the ones that need to be absolutely just and fair and across the board in our equal treatment of all people. And so let's put that into practice. Verse number 17. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. So you shouldn't be harboring this bad feeling toward other people. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. So you can be upset with them about something and tell them about it. You might even bring charges against them in the legal system because what they did was not fair. But you don't just go around hating them. You're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself. That's actually an Old Testament principle, not just simply a New Testament principle. And so the Israelis are supposed to be learning this lesson. Verse 18, you shall not take vengeance. Now, vengeance is where you take the law into your own hands, meaning that your neighbor does something to you that might involve them being fined. Well, you don't just go over to their house and take something of that value. It needs to go through the court system. Your neighbor might have done something that would result in corporal punishment. That is, in the Jewish historical time period, basically getting a public spanking as an adult. Well, you don't get to decide, well, they deserve a public spanking, and you go over and you whoop on them. No, that's not appropriate. You're not supposed to be taking the law into your own hands. You're not supposed to be taking vengeance. You're supposed to let the authorities take care of that. And in addition to that, this verse says you've got to have a good attitude. It says, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people. So you're not supposed to have this bad attitude toward those that even may have mistreated you improperly. You're supposed to leave that in the hands of the Lord. And then this is the time where we actually find the Old Testament quote, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am He who is. So Leviticus 19:18 is where part B of the greatest commandment is found. Part A, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's Deuteronomy 6. And then here, love your neighbor as yourself. Let's definitely put those things into practice. Verse 19, you are to keep my statutes You shall not breed together two kinds of your cattle. Now, the wording here, not quite, I think, accurate for our English, because you can't breed sheep with cattle, like cows and sheep can't be crossbred. So that's not what it's talking about here. The word actually means to lie them down together. Now, there is a very appropriate symbolic use of that word in Hebrew for sexual activity. And so that's where I think the New American Standard translators were going with it. But I think they should have thought through it a little bit harder. What's effectively being said here is you don't keep cattle and goats together. You don't keep cattle and sheep together. And, you know, American history out on the range kind of told you that that didn't work so well. So you don't keep two different kinds of animal in the same field. Then the next line, you shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed. Now, remember, they did broadcast seeding. And it would be kind of stupid to sow your flax and your wheat into the same field, because they're going to ripen at different times and you're going to harvest them for different purposes. You know, the wheat is going to be for eating and the flax is going to be used for making the linen products of your life. So don't be mixing the two types of seeds together in the same sort of field. Not appropriate. Then kind of extending on that, nor wear a garment upon you of two kinds of material mixed together. And what they meant by this, don't mix linen, which is a product of agriculture, and wool, which is a product of husbandry. It's an animal byproduct, wool. So you don't weave together two totally different types of material into the same fabric. Now, what's the point of this? There is a larger lesson that God is trying to teach through these instructions, and that is you can't have godly people and ungodly people in the same field, you know, in the same flock. You can't have them in the same field, you can't have them in the same clothing because they're different from one another. So God is trying to teach the Israelis to think of themselves as being different than the peoples of the world. In the New Testament, Paul tries to get this across with a different Old Testament example. And he's actually trying to teach this to Christians. And that is, you should not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. Now, we typically think about that passage from Paul being about marriage, but it's actually about all sorts of intimate interactions with Gentiles. Unequally yoked means you don't stick like an ox and a donkey together in the same double-team yoke. They're not the same animals. They're not going to pull in the same way. They're not going to cooperate. So you can't have Christians and non-Christians being married together because they're not going to approach life in the same way. Nor can you really have Christians and non-Christians being involved as really intimate business partners, because you're going to run into problems as to moral approaches to business, more than likely. And so that's what he's trying to kind of get across by these illustrations. Just like cattle and sheep shouldn't be together in the same field, so holy people shouldn't be trying to live their lives in close fellowship to unholy people. It's just not going to work. Verse number 20. Now, if a man lies carnally with a woman who is a slave acquired by another man, so we're talking about sexual relationship here, but who has in no way been redeemed nor given her freedom, there shall be punishment. They shall not, however, be put to death because she was not free. Now, we're not talking about a rape situation here. I don't know why so many people that don't like the Bible immediately assume that this is all about a rape situation. It's not. This is apparently a single man who falls into some sort of relationship with a woman who is a slave. So she owes money, or her family owed money. Somebody owed money, more than likely, for her to be in a slave situation. So she is not capable of acting on her own at this point. Well, if they get into some sort of sexual relationship, they're not to be treated as if they're committing some sort of adulterous sinful activity. That would be execution. They are to be treated as if it was an illicit relationship sexually. So there's going to be probably some money exchange hands. Verse 21, he shall bring his guilt offering to he who is to the doorway of the tent of meeting, a ram for a guilt offering. And the priest also shall make atonement for him with a ram of the guilt offering before he who is for his sin which he's committed, and the sin which he has committed will be forgiven him. Now, given some information we have in other places with similar situations, it is possible that he could then offer to pay off her debt and extend perhaps some sort of bride price, so that he could marry her. But it's not mentioned in the context here, because the big point was this is not a capital crime. This is a crime that involves repentance and making things right. Okay, so we're out of time for the day. So we'll pick up at Leviticus 19:23 tomorrow when we get back into the Word.